Welcome to another edition of the Health First Show. I'm your host, Dave Fuller, and today we got a great show lined up for you. We're going to be talking with Kate Barrington. She's the author of Hashimoto's Thyroid. And you know what? I'm going to let Kate tell you when she comes on the show. But we're talking about Hashimoto's disease. And the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about brain fog with Dr. Kate Ram-Blue. But before we do that, here's Ellen with the health news.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is banning most antibacterial soaps and body washes currently on store shelves, arguing that the products create potential health risks, but don't perform any better than plain old soap and water. The ban covers soaps and body washes containing triclosan and triclocarbon, the two most common antibacterial ingredients, the FDA says. Another 17 active ingredients also included in the ban. Most consumer wash products labeled antibacterial or antimicrobial contain at least one of the antibacterial ingredients addressed in this final rule, said Dr. Teresa Michel, director of the Division of Non-Prescription Drug Products at the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. There are more than 2,100 antibacterial soaps sold today, representing about 41% of the overall soap market, Michelle said during a media briefing recently. The agency said it took this action over concerns that antibacterial soaps might be contributing to bacterial resistance. Encouraging your kids to eat right, exercise, and limit screen time may not be enough to instill healthy habits. You also need to lead by example, researchers suggest. Although any support parents can give is good, said study author Dr. Heather Manson, we found children were more likely to meet guidelines if parents were giving active, engaged support. That means taking your child to the park for play, making healthy food options readily available, and restricting screen time, said Manson, chief of health promotion, chronic disease, and injury prevention at Public Health Ontario. For this new study, the researchers conducted a telephone survey of more than 3,200 parents with at least one child under age 18 in Ontario. Parents were asked about behaviors related to national guidelines for physical activity, healthy eating, and appropriate TV screen time. The study was recently published in BMC Public Health. Popular drug-free methods of managing pain from such common conditions as headaches and arthritis appear to be effective, according to a new review. Millions of Americans seek pain relief through such alternatives as acupuncture, tai chi, and yoga, but there has been little information to help doctors make recommendations about these approaches. In a U.S. government news release, study lead author Richard Nahan said for many Americans who suffer from chronic pain, medications may not completely relieve pain and can produce unwanted side effects. As a result, many people may turn to non-drug approaches to help manage their pain. Our goal for this study was to provide relevant, high-quality information for primary care providers and for patients who suffer from chronic pain, he added. He is the lead epidemiologist at the U.S. National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. Researchers reviewed 105 U.S.-based clinical trials from the past 50 years. The study was published September 1st in the journal Mayo Clinic Proceedings. Most American adults who suffer from depression aren't getting treatment, a new study finds. After screening survey data on more than 46,000 people, researchers found that 8% had depression, but only a third were being treated for the mood disorder. The reasons why were varied. Lead researcher Dr. Mark Olfson said some adults who experience depressive symptoms do not believe they are significant and require medical attention, or that they could benefit from treatment. For others, stigma or shame interferes with the desire to get professional help, said Olfson, a professor of psychiatry at the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Columbia University, New York City. In still other cases, the medical visits are oriented around more pressing and urgent medical problems, and the clinical opportunities to detect depression are missed, he said. The study was published August 29th in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine. It relied on self-reported information, which can sometimes be inaccurate, the researchers noted.
Thanks for that, Alan. Well, our first guest is Kate Barrington. She's the author of Hashimoto's Thyroiditis. And she's also the author of The Dash Diet. Kate, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Hashimoto's, because, you know, there's probably a lot of people that don't understand what it is, and it's, you know, maybe even Japanese to them.
Yeah, it's actually pretty interesting, because Hashimoto's is not sort of a name you hear very often, but it actually affects about 14 million people in the United States alone.
Wow.
That's about 8% of our population, so it's a pretty big deal.
And so if it's affecting so many people, how come we don't hear about it?
I think a lot of it is that people don't always realize they have it, or they get the symptoms confused with other disorders, because it's an autoimmune disorder, and a lot of those symptoms sort of overlap. People don't realize exactly what they have, or there's no like exact test to tell you that you have an autoimmune disorder. Got to test for specific ones, really.
Okay. So what is Hashimoto's, and what are the symptoms?
So Hashimoto's disease is an autoimmune disease that affects your thyroid gland. So autoimmune diseases happen when your immune system basically kicks into high gear and it starts to think that your tissues, your own tissues in your body, are foreign invaders, and so it starts to attack them. Mm-hmm. And with Hashimoto's, it attacks the thyroid gland. And the thyroid gland is within your neck. It's sort of around your trachea under the Adam's apple, and it produces these hormones that actually help to control your metabolism, your heart rate, things like that, like how fast you burn energy. So one of the biggest symptoms of Hashimoto's then is just kind of feeling tired all the time, feeling sort of depressed, memory loss, muscle aches, pain, just kind of things related to hormone imbalance. But a lot of people don't actually develop symptoms until they're a couple of months or even years in, once the, depends how fast that damage to the thyroid is happening.
What is the difference between Hashimoto's and like hypothyroidism?
Hypothyroidism is actually often secondary to Hashimoto's. Hashimoto's is the number one cause of hypothyroidism. So I guess hypothyroidism, you could say, might be a symptom or a consequence of Hashimoto's.
Okay. And tell us, Kate, you know, what made you interested in this topic? What got you to write the book?
Well, I actually have an autoimmune disease myself. I was diagnosed with celiac disease about 5 years ago, and that's an autoimmune reaction to the consumption of gluten. So I have to follow a gluten-free diet for medical reasons. And I'm also sort of just a health writer. I do a lot of research about health topics, and autoimmune diseases are really interesting because there's so many of them, and so many people have them, but there's still so much research that needs to be done. There aren't cures for any of these autoimmune diseases, and scientists still don't understand the exact causes. And they estimate that as many as 1 out of 12 men and 1 out of 9 women have some kind of autoimmune disease.
What's the relationship between autoimmune disease and stress?
Stress can really exacerbate autoimmune disease. I think a lot of autoimmune diseases can lie dormant. Like, you can have genetic predisposition for it, which is actually what happened to me. I had the genetic predisposition, but I didn't actually develop the disease. It didn't manifest until a couple of years ago after a period of extreme stress. So stress can just be one of those triggers that sort of brings it out of hiding.
And Kate, you know, when you're researching this, you probably, I imagine you're talking to people that had Hashimoto's disease. What do they say, you know, is the first thing that they really notice?
For a lot of people, it's just kind of that chronic fatigue. They don't feel well for a while, but the first actual physical symptom or like noticeable symptom that a lot of people get is a goiter, which is like a swelling in your neck, which is, yeah, it's pretty obvious. And it's not usually painful, but it can make it difficult to swallow. And then from there, that's when people usually start getting tested for the thyroid hormone and things like that.
Right. And, you know, in terms of the thyroid issues, what, you know, can they be reversed?
It can be reversed. Well, you can go into remission, basically. Autoimmune diseases can't be cured, but for Hashimoto's, you can start taking synthetic thyroid hormone, which will sort of restore your thyroid function back to normal or near normal. And certainly dietary changes can really help with that also, to sort of reduce the chronic inflammation that's going on and doing a lot of the damage.
And, you know, Kate, when people get the, you know, they start to get the symptoms of Hashimoto's, how long does it take for the disease to progress?
It really varies from one person to another. For some people, you can have it for a while. It can take like years for those first symptoms to develop. And it just depends how fast your immune system sort of declines and attacks you. And different things like being overweight or taking certain medications, having other health issues can cause it to move faster or slower for you.
Right. And in terms of, you know, people that get it, is it more women than men, or is there any subsets of the population that really have this disease?
Yeah, it's actually more common in women than men, and it usually manifests between the ages of 30 and 50. It does sort of tend to run in families, but scientists haven't really identified the specific gene that's responsible for it.
Right, and what kind of, you know, what kind of treatment options do they have for Hashimoto's?
Well, the one treatment option that pretty much everyone uses, because it's the most effective one, is to take some kind of synthetic thyroid hormone to just replace the hormone that your thyroid isn't making.
Right. So, and what happens when people do that?
What happens when people do that? They start to, their hormone levels start to normalize, and the thyroid starts to sort of kick back into doing what it's supposed to be doing. And as long as they do some dietary changes also, they can start healing their body from the effects of those hormonal imbalances.
Well, let's talk a little bit about diet. So if, you know, I think that if I'm starting to get a goiter and, you know, I'm feeling my metabolism slowing down, is there things that I can do right away in terms of my diet that are not harmful either way that I should be considering?
Yeah, and most of the dietary sort of recommendations for Hashimoto's are based on eliminating certain foods that are exacerbating the damage. Because once your immune system sort of starts damaging things, it really damages your digestive system, because that's where a lot of your immune system cells are located. So you want to start cutting out things that can cause chronic inflammation and stress to your digestive system, and that's things like dairy, gluten, grain, sugar, alcohol, just kind of all that stuff you know is bad for you, but you eat it anyway.
Right. And when people start cutting back on this, what do they notice?
Well, when your digestive system starts to heal, your digestion will be more regular. You'll get a little more of your energy back, because that damage to your digestive system sort of interferes with the absorption of nutrients. Uh-huh. So once you start getting the nutrition you need, you start feeling better in general, and that sort of helps kick everything back into normal range.
Right. And, you know, in the beginning of your book, you talk about some of the risk factors that correlate with Hashimoto's. What are they? What happens when people get Hashimoto's?
Well, like I said, there's definitely a genetic component. If someone in your family has Hashimoto's disease, then you have a higher risk of getting it. Also, if you have any sort of autoimmune disease, that'll increase your risk factors also. Being overweight, women, I guess, are more likely to get it. And kind of your age, like I mentioned before, it tends to sort of manifest around middle age.
We're talking with Kate Barrington. She's the author of Hashimoto's Thyroiditis Healing Diet. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be finding out more about what you can do if you have this disease and how you can prevent it, and, you know, some of the diet that you could, you know, some of the recipes that you can use to really support it.